Rose Levy Birnbaum's The Cake Bible demystified the process of baking a beautiful cake with its clear and exact instructions. And from 1988 on, that book has fulfilled its title's promise, becoming the word in baking. It's been over two decades since, but the faithful are about to receive their just reward with the publication of Rose's Heavenly Cakes, featuring equally precise instructions for 100 more fabulous concoctions. It is published by Wiley, and I'm very pleased that it brings Rose Levy Birnbaum back to our show. Hi.
Hi, Lenny.
And I remember we talked about the Cake Bible when it first came out, and one of the things that the key innovations of it was that you measure things by weight.
Yes, and happily, a lot of people have come along with that idea. Once they try it, they'll not go back to measuring. It's
now,
so much
faster. Why is it so important?
Well, it's easier. I mean, you could say it's more accurate, but if you're careful in measuring by volume, it's equally accurate. But think of the speed of having everything just in one bowl. When you have the flour, the sugar, you don't have to sift it or dust it lightly into the cup and level it off and wonder or shake, God forbid, you know, do the tap dance. Because if you end up with too much flour, you get a dry cake, which is a lot of people's problems.
Well, bakers weigh it, don't they? And
yeah,
you
absolutely.
And you avoid that other problem where you're doing, you're saying one, two, three. Somebody said, ask you a question, you say, what, where was I?
Good point. And
with
afterwards,
the scale, it's always there.
Yeah, plus you can weigh it at the end and see how much batter you have and know if you left out a major component, which also can happen. But you know, Lenny, these days, scales that are really accurate are really affordable. I paid $2,000 for my accurate scale 21 years ago, but now you can get one for $45. It's marvelous.
What, there's also a difference in the density of different flours, isn't there? I've been told that that King Arthur is a different density than Pillsbury.
Well, it's more the type. If it's all-purpose versus cake, for example, a cup of cake flour in weight would be 3/4 cup, or 3/4 cup plus 2 tablespoons of all-purpose, and that makes a difference when you're using 3 cups. But a lot of people just think flour is flour, and even unbleached flour weighs more than bleached. Because the bleaching process, you lose a little liquid, you lose a little protein, you know. And
I would have thought the bleach would have added some weight, but, well. Are these recipes more difficult than the ones in the previous book?
Oddly enough, they're more easy, and that's probably for two reasons. Although I still am known for meticulous recipe writing and details, I've gotten more poetic about it. You know, as you get older and you write, this is my 9th book, my first return to cakes, but my 9th book, the more you write, the more streamlined you can become. I wanted to have all the information so that people would not get into trouble when they're doing it, but I wanted to do it in a way where nothing unnecessary was mentioned.
In the case of baking, you really do have to be precise. Now, you also did a book Bible, I mean a bread Bible.
Yeah.
Did you learn anything about making cakes when you were making bread?
Yes, because bread is so flour dependent that working with different types of flour gave me a lot of inspiration of how I could make new types of cakes. For example, the Wonder Flour, that has always been used just for biscuits, maybe, but usually gravy and sauces, is absolutely amazing when you use it to make a Genoise or a sponge cake or ladyfingers. It's just lighter, and with an angel food cake, you don't have to sift it, and it's much more ethereal. So, you know, this taught me to investigate my ingredients more thoroughly. I must say, I love bread baking. You know, I always thought, well, that's something I won't have to do by measure. I can just do by feel. But it turns out that when you weigh things, it's no longer a mystery. You know, it just every time the bread came out the same.
And that's important in baking. It's not the same when you're doing other kinds of cooking where a certain amount of improvisation is actually encouraged.
Yeah, because even if you're off by something or you make a mistake, it's still edible. Whereas with a cake, if you make a mistake, usually it affects the texture, which then affects the flavor. Although I have to admit that once I was dumping just one cake, it was a chocolate cake that I thought was beyond redemption and not even good for people in the building who might love it anyway. And I was dumping it in the garbage disposal when a neighbor came out and she said, "What are you doing?" And I said, "This one isn't even worth your eating." And that sounded insulting, but not when she responded with, "Don't you realize that your disasters are our life's delights?" And she took the cake.
Well, you were using fine ingredients. I'm sure it was better chocolate than you got at the local supermarket.
A failed chocolate is better than a failed anything else because, for example, if you underbake it, it becomes fudgy, so that's good. If you underbake a yellow cake, it becomes ooky, you know, and then the taste is bitter, so you can't hide that.
I remember Pierre Frenet talking about a cake that it became a staple at Le Pavillon, and it was because they had accidentally put double the amount of butter in it, And they thought it was a disaster, and then it became the most popular cake they had.
Well, how about quadruple the butter? My contribution to the new joy of cooking, the one that was totally revised, was my classic pound cake, in which I said I worked in the maximum amount of butter. They quadrupled it. So I had to make it and see what it was like. Everybody loved it. It's like eating a brick of butter held together with a little bit of flour, which just goes to show that people do love butter.
But you have all these cakes in here that are made with oil.
Yeah, see, I was going to address the fact that when you asked me if these cakes are easier, they are easier because my taste has become more refined in a way. You know, I'd rather have fewer elements and things that don't require lots of icing and decoration to look good. You know, just think about the purity of the flavors and also the beauty of the cake itself. When you bake in a tube pan, you get the shape of the tube pan, and if it's a moist cake, then you don't need to put anything. And the reason it's moist is because of oil.
But oil gives it a different texture than butter, doesn't it?
Well, the beauty of the oil is that when you refrigerate it, it stays soft, so it doesn't become like a brick the way a butter cake would be. Now, it would be fine to let a butter cake come out of the refrigerator if you're storing it and sit at room temperature, but what about the buttercream on the top or the whipped cream? So I thought, wouldn't it be nice to have a lighter thing like whipped cream on the top of a cake and allow it to sit in the refrigerator and be wonderful refrigerated? And, of course, our American chiffon cake has always been made with oil. But it has other flavors to give it some taste, you know. But if you're doing what's supposed to be a butter layer cake, where it's dependent on butter for its main flavor, it's pointless. And that's why I chose cakes like carrot cake that has spice and carrots, and pumpkin cake that really are enhanced with the oil.
Any oils preferable over others?
Safflower and canola are the type that I use the most. Sometimes I'll even use walnut oil if there are walnuts in the cake. One thing I won't use is olive oil, because I happen not to like the flavor of olive with sweets, just as I don't really like a lard crust with sweets. I love it with savory or quiche.
Who is David Shema, and how does he work with you?
Well, David actually worked with me when he started out, before he even went to culinary school, as a very young boy, giving me ideas, trying to get me to do things, and he was out there with all these other chefs saying, so-and-so is doing this, and please do oil cakes. They really can be very wonderful. But the person who worked with me and tested every recipe in this new book umpteen times is a blogger who found me on the internet and asked me to be his sifu. And I said, you know, dessert's my specialty, not fish. And he said, no, I do Tai Chi, and sifu is master. And he said, I can only go so far. I have physical limitations with the Tai Chi, but I think baking is my calling. I happened to go to General Mills to do a cookie exchange, and he lived there, and he brought me two cakes he had made, and I didn't remember that my version was even as good as his. So it took a lot of training, and if not for technology with digital cameras and cell phones so that you didn't have to pay these huge long-distance rates, I don't think we could have done it. But he became a totally reliable and inspirational assistant, to the point where I insisted he be mentioned, not only mentioned, but photographed in the book.
My guest is Rose Levy-Birnbaum, whose latest book is called Rose's Heavenly Cakes. It's published by Wiley. You talked about his cakes coming out even better than yours. This is always a problem, isn't it, that we see this gorgeous photograph in a book, and when we do it, it just does not come out as perfectly, and we don't know what we did wrong. We followed the instructions absolutely to the letter of the law.
That's why I'm doing something on my blog called Outcakes, where I do pictures of all the behind-scenes things and the way it looked when I made it versus when the stylist made it, the different possibilities. But the truth is that, well, people keep saying I shouldn't pat myself on the back, but they're always mentioning how generous I am because I give so many recipes and help so many people on the blog. And it's probably out of that same spirit of generosity that I say that his cakes that he did of mine were better than mine. It was simply I hadn't made them for several years and forgot just how good they were, and he was that good.
Well, there in the end, one of the things you do here to help us avoid those problems is you really go into meticulous detail.
That is the whole purpose of giving the detailed directions. And I try to separate out things that people might not need to know, who are already experienced bakers, so they don't have to reread it each time. It's separated into other parts, you know, on the same page, though, so you wouldn't miss it. And also, I think a very important thing that I've added is the make ahead things that, I mean, suddenly you're making a recipe and you realize you should have started 2 days before, and I think I really fought for that to be up front. The charts, you see immediately what you need, and you have the choice of ounces, grams, or the volume. Everything's there basically that you need, but this is my first book where every single thing, maybe two cakes that don't need to be, are pictured, plus some of the steps. So it gives a lot of guidance.
And tastes in cakes have changed. I mean, you have a whole batch of flourless cakes here. There are those lava cakes that suddenly became a fad a little while back.
Yeah, taste has changed, and luckily there's less sugar in cakes, I find. And there are a lot of people who can't have flour. I don't know why that is, and or if it's even true, or if they think they can't, but it seems that there are more allergies than there had been, more intolerances.
So and do the substitute flours work just as well?
That would be a whole other book, and I don't think I'm the one who's going to write it.
Spelt cakes.
I like a little spelt in bread, but as the basic thing. See, my philosophy is if you can't have something, make something else. Don't try to torture something else into it. But I've gotten a lot of criticism on the blog for saying that. They say you just don't know because you could never have bread again. And maybe that's true. But I didn't do the flourless cakes to address that problem. I did that because they're some of the best cakes in the book. And I was thinking, well, people may well say the tiramisu has lady fingers, but that's something that's made commercially that can be made without flour that's quite good. Or you could serve it over figs, where fresh figs would be probably even better than the lady fingers.
Did your mother bake?
I think she baked one thing once for my book. But my mother fixed teeth. She was a dentist. You know, I didn't have any sweets in the house growing
up.
Yeah,
she didn't want you having as much sugar as you later encouraged other people to have. So you don't have these childhood cake associations, the equivalent of the Proustian Madeleine?
Well, the only thing I really remember is a sponge cake that my grandmother bought. I mean, of course they bought babkas and I wouldn't eat them because, you know, children don't want elaborate things unless they've been taught to like it. So I was willing to try the sponge cake, and I remember that I liked it very much the first day, but by the second or third day, I didn't understand why, but I no longer wanted to eat it. And I remember Ariane Dagan saying about her little girl, who was only two, that she wouldn't eat a squab that had been frozen. You know, that some kids are born. It's genetic. That's why we go into the area that we do. We're born with a palate. I mean, they probably would have called me anorexic if they had known the word then, but it wasn't that. It was that things, I felt intense about flavors, and if I hated it, I couldn't eat it.
One section in this book is called Baby Cakes. Is that your take on the cupcake trend?
Yes. And not just cupcakes, but they don't have to be baked in that shape, but things that are little, that are served individually. I think that they fill a real need, but if you're making it as a wedding cake, you really need help because you have to work quickly when you have to make 150 these little things.
Your books give thorough descriptions and explanations of the science involved in making cakes. Well, people have been making cakes for a long time. Did they have any idea that they were engaged in some kind of a scientific experiment every time they made a dessert?
I think every time people used to describe me as a food scientist, I would shudder because they were the ones who had the reputation of knowing about theory but not about flavor. I think people have largely ignored science until things didn't work, and then that's when they started calling me, blogging, writing emails, and that's why books like Understanding on Food and Cooking, you know, Hal McGee's book, have become so popular. People realize that knowledge is power, and if you want to make something that will suit your taste, you can do it if you understand it better.
You open your book with a list of Rose's rules of cake baking. What's the single most important rule? Okay.
I would say don't substitute at least the first time around. I mean, I was just waiting for something to come rising
to my head. But I'm
thinking
about temperatures also.
Oh, yeah, the oven is the common denominator of failure. If your oven is off, it's definitely going to affect it.
And what about butter being softer or colder or eggs coming right out of the refrigerator?
All these things matter. And, you know, the rules are not that rigid and they're not that many. But I hated to write the word rule, but I wanted to grab people's attention because there are a lot of things people don't know. For example, they wonder why, still to this day, and to me, I thought everybody knew, that if you beat egg whites, and they never increase in volume and they don't become firm, it's because there's some grease, either from the egg yolk or in the bowl. You can use a little vinegar rinse. But these are the things that I consider my rules. They're all important. But what I hear the most often, which is why I came up with a substitution, is when people on my blog write, such and such happened, and then I write back, please sign a full disclosure. You know, like, what did you do? What did you do different? Because it's always something different. And it's always that they substituted.
Well, I've always been confused about what it means when they say three large eggs, because large eggs can be anything, or butter at cool room temperature.
That's why I started giving degrees, because that could mean anything, right?
So how do we take the temperature of butter?
Well, if you don't have an instant read thermometer, which most people have even for meat, then, and it's between 65 and 75, and kitchens tend to be around 85 with all the heat generating from the machinery. But really, you can tell just to feel it, because when you press it down, it's still firm, but you can press it. And you can just leave it in a cool room. It's not going to get anything dirty.
Well, there's another problem. Some people's stoves aren't always as accurate as you would like. Are there better places to put the cake as you're baking it?
Than a stove?
in the oven.
I'm not sure what you mean by that question.
Well, I mean, sometimes when I've set my oven to 350 degrees, I worry, you know, I use that little thermometer inside, but that isn't always that accurate either.
And you're right.
And one day it comes out in a very short time. The next time it seems to take much longer to bake. You never know.
Yeah, you're right, Lenny. If it bakes in too fast a time, it will be domed and cracked. And if it's not enough, it will be sinking. So you can base the oven temperature on how long it takes to bake one of my cakes. And if it falls between that range, it's right. If it doesn't, adjust the thermostat 25 degrees in the direction.
So. We have a recipe for a Swedish pear and almond cream cake and also your whipped cream cake on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, Rose's Heavenly Cakes, is published by Wiley with lots of wonderful pictures. And I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Oh, it's such a pleasure. I'm sorry I have to wait another 10 years.